I want to talk about the gene chip and about what that's meaning in animal science these days and how much it is going to continue to mean over the next several years. If you think about it, two cows, the first farmer, looked at two cows who mysteriously ate more of one forage than another, and he wondered why, and it turned out, oh, we figured out digestibility, didn't we? Intake minus outgo divided by intake. We got a long ways with that method, didn't we? And eventually we're fractionating carbohydrates and diets that we feed. We're looking at the same kinds of things in amino acids and protein. And then we started looking in terms of bioavailability, which in many cases just isn't any different from digestibility in terms of the math. But things have gone on quite a bit. 1970s and the 1980s, we started looking at rumen microbiology much more closely. And that really did explain a lot of things. It explained a tremendous number of things about the rumen, Altec's first fermenter, your first favorite fermenter. You'll see more about our second favorite fermenter when you tour the distillery this afternoon. But the gene chip has made a tremendous breakthrough. And I'll tell you from the beginning, the reason that we're most excited about this is because now we really have a way to start closing that gap between genetics and nutrition that we've been talking about for so long. Because we're able to measure gene expression. This is the first really new way of measuring response in our animals we've had for a long time, and it's very exciting. And we're still asking what's limiting, which is what we as people who feed cattle, people who design diets for them, have always asked. What's limiting? Is there a limiting nutrient? Is there some limiting circumstance that is keeping our animals from expressing that genetic potential? And we talk about, oh, is it genetics? Is it nutrition? Is it health? But now we finally have a way. We all recognize that this gap exists. And we also recognize that even if we meet what we know of are the most modern forms of the nutrient requirements that we can provide an animal, but still, that's not allowing the animal to completely express its genetic potential. The same with health or environment. The weather can be perfectly good. There can be no health challenges, yet we know that that cow can produce more. But that calf can gain faster, produce a different quality of meat. So what's limiting here? It's us. It has been our understanding of how things work. This is why this new method, the gene chip, is so important to us. Peter Furquette explained this very well. He's a professor of poultry science at North Carolina State University, and at the Altec Symposium last year, he had an excellent presentation. And he reminded us that genetics did give us better animals. It did change the playing field. But it's expression of that genetic potential, it's gene expression, that drives performance and ultimately drives profits. Well, how do we focus on gene expression? How do we see how the changes in diet, changes in some aspect of health management, how does that change gene expression? Before the advent of the gene chip, we were not able to do that. Talk about what the gene chip is, and I will assure you, I'm talking to you from an animal nutritionist perspective. I'm not a molecular biologist, so I'm going to spare you the technology of how this thing exactly works, the technology behind it itself. It's fascinating if you are a molecular biologist, and after that, it gets a bit mind-numbing. Now, excellent explanations of our use of this gene chip and how it works in a laboratory environment. If you tour the Altec facility, and I hope you do, Altec has committed quite a bit of our resources to nutrigenomics research, and our Animal Science and Nutrigenomics Research Center is someplace we would very much like you to visit. But take a look at this. Now I'm going to give it a toss, so be careful here. Pass it around and have a look at it. It's going to have a big impact on your business lives and actually on health as well. First of all, what is it? That the chip that I've handed you around there, a gene chip contains the entire genome of an animal on that one small gene chip. That's a bovine, unless I've thrown you a chicken or a pig. Contains the entire gene. Many copies of, many fragments of the genes are represented on it. It's used to measure gene expression, which is what I'm talking about here. It's also to detect the SNPs, the single nucleotide polymorphisms. That is one of the health-related aspects in human health in which a gene chip type application is used. And to genotype or screen. This is a DNA microarray, the entire genome of the animal on that chip. This is a game changer. For one reason, it's a very large number of genes that we can measure at once. Huge amount of data can be gathered at once, and it's a very small size. That combination makes it a game changer in terms of our biologist's ability to measure things anyway, but it provides a huge amount of data. And you and I need to know a lot more about how things work if we expect to get more meat, more milk out of animals and out of our forages and grains. But why? Why are we measuring gene expression? Now, crank back or have a flashback to biology. All cells, virtually all cells in your body or in every tissue have a complete set of chromosomes with identical genes, but not all are expressed in every cell. How the liver knows to be liver cells and so forth. We measure the types and amounts of the messenger RNA. DNA in each of these cells is transcribed to messenger RNA, which is translated into proteins. Now those proteins are what performs the various biofunctions, all of the biofunctions of the body. So we need to know what types of proteins are being produced. We measure gene expression or the amounts of mRNA to see what proteins that cells are producing. Think how far that is from a test tube and a petri dish. We're able to look at gene expression in types of cells in different organs and tissues throughout the body. We're seeing exactly what proteins are being produced, as opposed to seeing a reflection of them in a wet chemistry experiment or in a petri dish for counting microbes. It's a huge leap forward in methods for us. So what do we learn? Well, we've learned something very quickly about nutrition, and this is a game changer, certainly in my mind, as being trained as a nutritionist. It changes totally how we think about nutrients. You know how it went when you took that class in nutrition or whatever it was. Nutrients are building blocks, they're cofactors, and so forth. Well, indeed they are, but when we start looking at the gene chip, when we look at the DNA microarrays, we stop thinking of them that way. We see the way that nutrients flow through a system. And, very importantly, we see the fact that nutrients are act as gene switches. In many circumstances, they can turn on or turn off, switch on, upregulate or downregulate. That's more like volume control, actually. The ways in which genes are expressed. That's pretty important information to us when we look at what we want, metabolism of nutrients, and its effects on performance. The other important thing we learned are that how things interact, how things work together. And we find that discoveries these days, now probably there's not going to be another vitamin D discovered, is there? Probably all of those kinds of things have been discovered. But interactions of those nutrients, how things are metabolized, we have so much to learn there. Discoveries these days, our moves forward are going to be at those interactions on how things work together. In other words, it's not genetics or health or environment or nutrition exactly that's limiting. It's how they interact. And it's learning those, being able to manipulate those interactions is how we move forward. It's how we look at how we develop our products and solutions as well. Now, this is a huge game changer in animal science as well. It offers us a way of reducing animal testing. Now, you're thinking, well, that's not going to replace performance trials, and it certainly doesn't. But think of all the kinds of things that we do over and over again in terms of animal trials. Also, I know that you think of economic efficiency, as Jack mentioned, in terms of your beef and dairy units. Well, look at the sort of experimental efficiency that results here. In a PhD trial, a set of trials to get a PhD, you probably do an animal trial. You would gather production information about a set of animals. You would look at rumen function parameters, blood-related things, and you'd measure quite a few things, wouldn't you? But when we use the gene chip, we have tens of thousands of measurements. Plus, the functions as a library. We can always go back to those. Every experiment that we have done in nutrigenomics becomes part of a library that we use. So a smaller number of animals, we have fewer opportunities for large-scale animal testing these days anyway. We can also ask a lot harder questions. A lot harder questions about metabolism, and we can ask a lot more questions and continue to learn from that body of information as time moves on. That interaction is a huge important in animal science, but also think of it, Dr. Lyons showed this slide as well. Say we wanted to look at an interaction of things, say a functional carb rate, the form of zinc, and maybe age of weaning, something like that. That's really not that complicated an interaction type animal science experiment, is it? Those of you who are familiar with animal science experiments, but the types of interactions that gene chip data gives us, we couldn't replicate all of that, particularly very quickly, in an animal trial. Yet we can learn a tremendous amount about how things work and move forward with it. The other huge offering that the gene chip gives us is it's been a breakthrough into the science of what is called nutrigenomics. And nutrigenomics is the study of those relationships between diet and gene expression. And that has gotten of interest to us both as human consumers and as those who rear animals for several ways, because we look at the ways in which nutrition programs respond. And we think in terms of how we might be able to nutritionally program some desired responses and to solve some of the problems we have in production and product production. Programming nutrition is interesting to us in two main areas. One is in prenatal nutrition, maternal nutrition. Fetal programming, we want to be able to set the stage for lifetime performance. Also in postnatal diets, we want to have a selection, we want to be able to select ingredients that target specific gene expression patterns. But a third thing that we have learned from nutrigenomics experiments and the work that's going on in this area right now is not just what you feed, it's also when you feed it. It can make a big difference in what happens as the animal grows. And we operate pretty much in a target-rich environment here, don't we? There are a number in each of these areas, whether it be digestive efficiency and digestive system function, reproductive function, there's a tremendous amount we don't know about reproductive function in cattle. Morbidity and mortality, our disease challenges, some of the early life disease problems, and then product quality in meat and milk. Are there different kinds of ways? Can we more closely target the product that we would like to produce with the way that we feed? Now, maternal nutrition is no stranger, none of us are any stranger to that. But it has a new emphasis these days in animal health. How many of you saw this cover of Time magazine not that long ago? It's very popular these days to do work on the fetal origins of human disease, heart disease, depression, all the rest of it, all of our absolute favorites, have been determined that can be influenced very early in life, during gestation. Exposure to an adverse stimuli during critical phases of gestation can alter how the organism grows and evident and eventually performs in the kinds of diseases it's subject to. Now, a lot of this we know because of something that happened in World War II. You may have heard of the Dutch Hunger Winter. Late in World War II, in the Western Netherlands, they were isolated. The Germans isolated this area. There were 4.5 million people affected. Thousands died. Thousands of people died. But caloric intake dropped from 2,000 to 500 to 700 calories a day. So a considerable drop in caloric intake and availability of food. However, this population wasn't refugees. They didn't leave this area. It was basically a large middle-class population, all ages of people, which remained and continued to live in that area. Because of that, a tremendous amount of study has been done with this group of people over the years. Now they are getting up there in age. And a number of correlation studies were looking at the health of this group of people. What are they dying of? And it's no, all of us know that if you reduce intake, you're restricted in intake during pregnancy, low birth weight results, right? Well, that certainly did result in babies that were born during this Dutch hunger winter. But also, several other kinds of things happened. They found that not only were the lower birth weight, there was a higher incidence of obesity, of diabetes, of cardiovascular disease. And also, this is in the first generation of children, but in the children born to the mothers of that generation, some similar kinds of things appeared. Now, this is what's known as epigenetics, epi meaning above genetics. And it's transmissible, and it's heritable. However, it doesn't affect the structure of the DNA. So, basically, your phenotype, you or me, or any individual of our animals, are a product of our genotype, which would be our entire genome, plus those transmissible epigenetic factors, and environmental influences. So we're interested in nutritional imprinting. How can we make a difference? How can we determine or promote that desired genetic trait, the gene expression, when the animal is very, very young? Now, the fetal programming recognizes that intrauterine environment, the largest factor of which is certainly maternal nutrition, exerts a huge influence on postnatal metabolism and growth, meat composition, and meat quality. We have some opportunities here, don't we, to change how some things happen. If you're a beef producer, it's got big implications for meat yield and quality. Amanda Webster was here last year and talked about these kinds of things. And I know that you are going to hear more and more about ways in which gene expression is altered by how we feed cows during gestation. But we're actually, when we talk about meat production, we're talking about the development of muscle and fat, aren't we? So we want to look at the origins of when those kinds of cells developed. And of course, that's during early fetal development. And that ultimately determines meat composition and what we're trying to produce, which is to increase the yield and quality of beef. But we're also reminded of a couple of things. Think of how we feed right now. In that mid-gestation period, this is a slide of Amanda's, that mid-gestation period, that's when we don't pay that much attention to beef cows, isn't it? Or to dairy cows, their own requirements are fairly low. However, as you can see here, that's when primary muscle development, secondary muscle development, starts to occur. There are only so many muscle cells. Those are determined in number of those cells very early in development. Rest of growth has to do with expanding those cells, the size of those cells, and satellite cells, and so forth. So that's of interest, and it makes you wonder, are we leaving some of our possibilities? So we left a few cards on the table here. Maybe it's possible that we change how we do this, or we take some opportunities that are presented there. This way of looking at nutrition is a sea change from our perspective on nutrients. As Dr. Lyons mentioned, not that long ago, we were formulating stress packs. And we were all opining to each other that, oh, a cow that had a disease challenge had a higher requirement for this or that micronutrient. That's certainly true. But we're looking now overall at gene expression. We have a totally different perspective. I like that word sea change. That's so much better than paradigm shift, I think. It sounds more dramatic. But today we look at form. We look at form, we look at metabolism of different types of forms. We look at the way nutrients are metabolized together. And that gene chip is the means we have for understanding that. And so conclusions, genetics gave us better animals. It's gene expression that drives performance and profits. It's important to remember. Nutrigenomics, that study of the effects of nutrition on gene expression, is key to narrowing that gap that we perceive between genetics and nutrition. It's not only in provision of nutrients and how we evaluate products and diet changes, but it also begins to change how we think about what requirements, what is required itself. Will some of our feeding conventions need to change? So, yes, they may well do, but those are opportunities that we'll be able to take advantage of. We have a lot to learn in this particular area, but we are learning those things very fast, and it's going to be important to use what we know. That's the impetus behind our developing a solutions program where we can learn to use these kinds of things together, because it is an absolute game changer in food animal nutrition. Thank you very much.